wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is the 21st edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled Playing Russian Roulette in the Carbon Markets. In this, the 21st edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the hottest market on the globe. Well, it's actually the market designed to cool things down a bit, the global carbon market.
A lithium dose just might cure your depression, but carbon is a girl's best friend.
When we make decisions, we want to make sure we do so on sound science. Not what sounds good, but what is real. And the United States leads the world in providing that kind of research. The approach taken under the Kyoto Protocol would have required the United States to make deep and immediate cuts in our economy to meet an arbitrary target.
Last month, there was finally an agreement between the Commission, the Parliament, and the European Council, which is the member states, on how to put together a European emission trading system. The system is relatively sound in terms of the structure of it, the monitoring and verification. I don't think anybody's now expecting the US to join in this round. It's not just about rejecting Kyoto as such, but the US, and this really went under the Clinton administration as well as the Bush administration, has largely adopted not to do anything about climate change. Some of the U.S. climate team does seem to spend a disproportionate amount of time in Russia. So I think, on the whole, the U.S. administration would prefer to see Russia not ratify, simply because the continuing existence of an international regime to deal with a problem that the Bush administration says doesn't exist is probably a bit of embarrassment.
CO2E is a subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald. We are brokers, and we broker all of the global emissions markets. Now, I run the global business. Really, all of the global emissions markets for greenhouse gases are all inspired by or sort of caused in one way or another by the Kyoto Protocol. The EU system is huge. It's 25 countries going to deal in allowances which have an issued face value of about 20 billion euros per annum.
Well, what we're going to do next is to take you to the Senate floor on Monday, where Senator Inhofe spoke. He was speaking about the issue of what he calls environmental extremists, and the whole issue of global warming.
I've offered compelling evidence that catastrophic global warming is a hoax. That conclusion is supported by painstaking work of the nation's top climate scientists.
Let's go back to the medieval warming period. The medieval warming period happened between about 1000 AD and 1350. And during that time, the Earth was actually warmer than it is today.
Look, my liege! Camelot! Camelot! Camelot!
It's only a model.
While the United States has developed a sudden fascination with the so-called Dark Ages, a time when the Earth was much toastier than it is today, the rest of the world is looking forward and has decided to do something about man-made weather impact. Most developed nations have now ratified the Kyoto Protocol of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, including all 25 member states of the European Union, as well as Canada and Japan. By ratifying the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, these countries have pledged to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by a significant amount over the next decade. This pro-Kyoto world has given up on the main country that has refused to ratify the protocol, the United States of America, who doesn't seem the least bit embarrassed by their noticeable gaseous emissions. Forging ahead, the Kyoto team holds out hope that Russia will join them by year-end 2003, which would finally bring the Kyoto Protocol officially into effect. In anticipation, this pro-Kyoto world is gearing up for compliance and is implementing new regulations, markets and market mechanisms, indeed a whole new way of doing business globally that the US is now being left out of. This episode of The Wizards of Money will explore the developments in the global carbon markets that have taken place mostly outside of the United States and get very little attention in this country. These developments include the world's first international market in carbon-based financial instruments, national taxes and levies on corporate energy use, and even a tax on cow farts and burps in New Zealand. To get to know these new markets, we'll talk to the Director of Global Operations at CO2E.com in London, the carbon emissions trading subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald, and we'll also talk to an energy specialist for the Climate Action Network in Brussels. But first, we'll start with a refresher on the cycle we can't afford to ignore anymore, the global carbon cycle.
Just might cure your depression, but carbon is a girl's best friend. And gold may be grand, but it won't start a fire in your barbecue or put the toot in your choo-choo, 'cause life on Earth is carbon-based. It came here on rocks from outer space and formed organic compounds till the carbon cycle went round and round. Carbon is a girl's best friend. Well, there may come a time when you need to do some squeezing. Carbon is the world's hardest friend. And there may come a time when a substrate is needed to deposit your to make hard carbon nitrides, but diamonds always win in the end. You know they do, darling. And I've heard that we need to find something much cleaner to put into our cars, or else we won't get very far, 'cause time rolls on and supplies will be gone of diamonds, coal and petroleum.
Just like with the water cycle that we spoke about in Wizards Part 7, only a tiny fraction of carbon on Earth actually participates in the carbon cycle relevant to us terrestrial creatures. And just like the water cycle, any carbon we have in our bodies today has certainly done the rounds over thousands or millions of years through plants, soils, other animals, the ocean, and the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution got underway, global carbon flows ran as follows. Carbon in the air, stored as carbon dioxide, is used by plants in photosynthesis and becomes part of the plant. Some of these plants get eaten by animals, and the carbon in them is used in various molecules to make body tissue and to burn up energy. Other plants, or parts of them like leaves, just get old and die. This decomposition releases some carbon back to the atmosphere, as does the process of respiration by animals. The other 99.9% of the world's carbon that didn't participate in this cycle just stayed underground, mostly buried in the ocean, in sedimentary rock, and in fossil fuels. Before fossil fuel use by humans entered the scene, losses of carbon from the earth and into the air from decaying vegetation and animal respiration in the form of gases such as carbon dioxide and methane were pretty much balanced by carbon storage or sequestration by plants during photosynthesis. The carbon cycle chugged along in this balance between about 1000 AD and the early 1800s, and so the amount of carbon in the air stayed pretty much constant over this time period since the Middle Ages. And to give you some idea of magnitude, this annual exchange was about 100 million gigatons of carbon, where a gigaton is a billion tons, from the Earth into the atmosphere, balanced by an equal exchange from the atmosphere back to the Earth. But then came the Industrial Revolution, powered by the burning of carbon-rich fossil fuels and accompanied by massive clearing of forest land for agriculture and other purposes. These two activities have extracted another 7 to 8 gigatons of carbon out of the Earth's sources per year, of which the oceans and the world's forests have decided to absorb just over half of this release. So the remaining 3 to 4 gigatons of carbon has nowhere to go but into the air. Over the past 200 years, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen by 30% and the amount of methane has more than doubled.
Well, what you've told me is a bundle of news, and no mistake. He and his foul folk are making havoc now. Down on the borders, they're felling trees. Good trees. Curse him, root and branch. Many of those trees were my friends. Creatures I'd known from nut and acorn. Many had voices of their own that are lost forever now. Yes. I will stop it. And you shall come with me. You may be able to help me.
An excess of carbon gases like carbon dioxide and methane are known to trap heat in the biosphere, making things toastier for all of us. This so-called global warming has many known and unknown impacts on climate. That humans have significantly increased the amount of carbon gases in the atmosphere, and that these gases do contribute to temperature increases, is generally not in dispute between the two main parties on either side of the Kyoto Protocol. What is under debate is the degree to which global warming is caused by natural versus man-made factors. The fairly recently discovered indications that the Middle Ages may have been warmer than current ages has the leadership in the US scrambling to promote studies to show that natural causes are a primary contributor to climate change. Satisfied that humans are contributing to climate change, the countries that have now ratified the 1997 Kyoto Protocol on global warming are trying to do what they can to get as much as possible of this excess carbon out of the atmosphere by implementing mechanisms designed to reduce overall carbon emissions. But the naysayers team, reluctant to give up their high carbon diets and led by United States and Australia, are diverting significant resources into figuring out how to stuff carbon waste underground or in the sea in a process known as artificial carbon sequestration. The US has also developed a sudden interest in the climate endured by King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, when temperatures were much warmer than they are today. If only they can understand why the mythical knights were so toasty, they can cast doubt on the idea that human-induced greenhouse gases are largely responsible for climate change.
We're knights of the round table, we dance where we're able. We do routines and order scenes and footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot, we eat ham and jam and spam a lot. We're knights of the round table, our shows are more mid-table. So many times we give and rhymes that are quite unstable. We're not so mad in Camelot, we sing from the diaphragm.
global climate change presents a different set of challenges and requires a different strategy. The science is more complex. The answers are less certain, and the technology is less developed. So we need a flexible approach that can adjust to new information and new technology. I reaffirm America's commitment to the United Nations Framework Convention and its central goal to stabilize atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations at a level that will prevent dangerous human interference with the climate. Our immediate goal is to reduce America's greenhouse gas emissions relative to the size of our economy. My administration is committed to cutting our nation's greenhouse gas intensity, how much we emit per unit of economic activity, by 18% over the next 10 years. This will set America on a path to slow the growth of our greenhouse gas emissions, and, as science justifies, to stop and then reverse the growth of emissions. This is the common sense way to measure progress. Our nation must have economic growth. Growth to create opportunity. Growth to create a higher quality of life for our citizens. Growth is also what pays for investments in clean technologies, increased conservation, and energy efficiencies. Our nation will continue to lead the world in basic climate science research to address gaps in our knowledge that are important to decision makers. When we make decisions, we want to make sure we do so on sound science. Not what sounds good, but what is real. And the United States leads the world in providing that kind of research. The approach taken under the Kyoto Protocol would have required the United States to make deep and immediate cuts in our economy to meet an arbitrary target. The United States will not interfere with the plans of any nation that chooses to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. But I will intend to work with nations, especially the poor and developing nations, to show the world that there is a better approach, that we can build our future prosperity along a cleaner and better path.
It's certainly true that international markets for various forms of carbon products already exist. Why, there are markets for diamonds, graphite, wood products, and, of course, fossil fuels themselves. But now there's a new carbon market. In this new carbon market, a monetary value is assigned to a carbon gas emission allowance. Such an allowance could only have a monetary value if there are a finite number of such emission allowances and the total amount allowed in the market is close to, or even below, the total amount that is currently being emitted. For this market to exist in the first place, there must be someone or some body, most likely a government body, that sets the total number of allowances for the market. This is exactly what the European Union has done. It has used the cap-and-trade approach to moving towards Kyoto targets, which for the EU requires greenhouse gas emissions to get to 92% of 1990 levels by the end of this decade. As announced on July 23, 2003, the European Commission has formally adopted a market structure for a cap-and-trade system for carbon dioxide emissions that will begin operations at the start of 2005. Under the EU Emissions Trading Scheme, the EU member states will set limits on carbon dioxide emissions from energy-intensive companies by issuing allowances for the amount of gas each is allowed to emit. The total number of allowances will reduce each year until the final target is reached. A company that is able to lower its emissions at relatively low cost may sell its excess allowances, and hence, the argument goes, the emissions market will act as a catalyst towards finding lowest cost emissions reduction solutions. Other companies that have difficulty meeting their targets inexpensively can buy these excess credits in the market at whatever the prevailing market price is. In effect, then, they are providing some of the financing to the seller of the credits for the seller's emissions reductions efforts, since this was cheaper than reducing emissions in their own operations. And if companies decide to neither meet their targets nor buy credits in the market to offset their excess, they will have to pay large fines to the government well in excess of the market price of credits. Steve Drummond, the Director of Global Operations for CO2E.com, the world's largest broker in this new market, explains the process.
Emissions trading is a concept which has been really developed and proven in the States. Cantor Fitzgerald, our parent company, has been trading emissions, helping its clients to trade emissions since the late 1970s. If you look at the US NOx and stocks markets, they've achieved reductions in emissions of over 85% at less than 10% of the actual cost that was forecast when they started. It's been a very, very successful program. And so emissions trading is really the cheapest known way to reduce emissions to a given target. And that's what emissions trading is about. CO2E is a subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald. We are brokers, and we broker all of the global emissions markets together with our colleagues in the States. So outside of the USA, that means mostly greenhouse gases and renewable energy. We do that in Canada and in Europe and in Japan. So I run the global business. Really, all of the global emissions markets for greenhouse gases are all inspired by or caused in one way or another by the Kyoto Protocol. The EU system is huge. It's 25 countries, at least, possibly with the addition of Switzerland and Norway, which takes it up to 27. And it's going to deal in allowances which have an issued face value of about 20 billion euros per annum.
What's the trading unit?
It's one allowance, which is one ton of carbon dioxide.
Well, how does the emissions get monitored? Are they independently monitored? It seems like it would be easy to lie about your emissions.
It's a whole system of verifiers who are credited by the government, and they sign off. So it's regulated.
It does seem like some kind of miracle that a bunch of 25 countries as diverse as the European Union, and who were at war with each other not so long ago, could unite over a proposal that is bound to bring some shocks to their local economies. Even the European environmental community seems fairly pleased with the EU's approach to global warming. But, like all such complex agreements involving so many varied parties and lots of different political interests, this one is not without controversy or room for abuse. Rob Bradley at the Climate Action Network in Brussels describes some of the main concerns.
My name is Rob Bradley, and I'm an energy specialist with Climate Action Network Europe. The Climate Action Network is actually a global network of environmental NGOs. So our members are NGOs like Environmental Defence, WWF, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and so on, but also a lot of organisations in developing countries. We were set up initially to coordinate input from the environmental NGOs into the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process, including the Kyoto Protocol and the follow-up conferences. But it's organised on a regional basis, so we're the Western European sort of centre for the network, and because we're based here in Brussels, we do a lot of EU policy work as well. Last month, there was finally an agreement between the Commission, the Parliament, and the European Council, which is the Member States, on how to put together a European emission trading system. Essentially, that system covers large point sources of carbon dioxide emissions. So we're talking about power plants, iron and steel facilities, oil refineries, cement kilns, glass manufacturers, and a couple of others. It will then set an absolute cap over those sectors. The system is relatively sound in terms of the structure of it, the monitoring and verification, and missing a target entails
a penalty of about 100 euros per ton of CO2. It's about $110 US, as an automatic penalty. So that ought to act as a fairly strong incentive to comply.
Looking at this from the US, but living in the US, mm-hmm. obviously we're much further behind than the European Union in doing anything about climate change. So this would seem to be quite an amazing development in the EU. However, you seem to have problems with the way that the markets are working. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean it's tricky because, as you say, if you're looking at it from a US perspective, I think that compared to anything that's really being proposed anywhere else in the world, this is actually a pretty good and pretty ambitious proposal. And certainly, you know, it's the kind of thing that that, you know, we would like to see treated as a leadership issue, and other countries start to follow. On the other hand, looking at this purely from a European perspective, and from an environmental perspective, we do have concerns. Now, I think one of the bigger concerns we've got coming up is actually comes in the form of a second directive. No sooner had the ink dried on the first one than another one is being proposed to link that emissions trading system with the Clean Development Mechanism and the Joint Implementation Mechanism, which are project mechanisms set up under the Kyoto Protocol. Now, essentially, the countries who have commitments under the Kyoto Protocol, commitments to actually limit their emissions, are, very roughly speaking, the OECD countries and the former communist bloc. Now, in addition to them making their own domestic emission cuts, they are allowed to sort of substitute for those in one of three ways, and these three ways are known as the flexible mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol. The more immediate ones that are proposed to connect with the EU emission trading system are joint implementation and the Clean Development Mechanism. Now, those provide for countries to undertake projects or to buy credits from projects undertaken by others that produce additional emission reductions and to use the credits coming from those in meeting their own target. So, for instance, if the UK was to go over its target by 10 million tons of CO2, it would need to get hold of credits arising from projects which have produced emission cuts of 10 million tons of CO2 equivalent. It can be done with other greenhouse gases. Now, that sounds all very well and good in theory, but in fact, in individual projects, demonstrating that you really have created an additional emission reduction is extremely difficult to do. And if you haven't generated an additional emission reduction, then essentially you're letting yourself off the hook in terms of meeting your own target while not making real additional investments elsewhere.
Well, how happy are you with the... you say it's difficult to demonstrate that you've met your emissions reductions targets. Are you happy with the system that works domestically?
Yes. The thing is that it's not so much that it's difficult to demonstrate that you have an emission of this level or that level. The thing is that, for instance, if we look at some of the projects that are being put together under the Clean Development Mechanism, there's a lot of large hydro dams there. Now, essentially, when a project developer comes along and says, I'm building a large hydro dam instead of building a coal-fired power station, look at all the emissions I've cut. It's not so much measuring the emissions that's the problem. Is that really what the alternative was? Are they really doing it instead of producing a coal-fired power station? Or is this a hydro dam that they were going to build anyway? If it's a hydro dam that they were going to build anyway, then it's not an excuse for them to shirk their own targets back home. If you're trying to measure the total emissions of a Western country, it's complex, but it's certainly not beyond the wit of man to be able to do that. Most emissions come from fossil fuels, and people know how much fossil fuels they burn. But these projects are much less certain. They also involve quite often serious impacts of other kinds in the developing countries.
And hydro dams are a very good example of that. I mean, we've got projects that have been touted as potential CDM projects, which involve evicting thousands of people from their land so that it can be reforested, or tens of thousands of people from their land so that it can be flooded for a large hydro system. You know, these things are projects which need to be very carefully considered on their own merits, not just used as an excuse to get us cheap carbon credits.
What's your opinion on carbon sequestration and how that seems to be emerging as a more important solution?
In geological formations?
Yes.
And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a more complex area than sort of carbon sequestration in plants, because theoretically, at least, you can find formations in which you can trap gas long term. For us, all of this misses the point, which is that the long term way of dealing with climate change and a number of other issues, you know, whether other kinds of pollution or whether security issues that we're facing and so on, is to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. And anything which diverts us away from that is essentially missing the point. Now, having said that, you know, if the climate science over the next few years is telling us, you know, you've got to reduce emissions massively and you've got to do it now, you know, would we be prepared to consider it? I think yes, it's an option which would need some thinking about. But essentially, it's, as I say, really missing the point.
Despite these concerns, these developments in Europe have really made the EU the world leader in trying to stem man-made contributions to climate change. And without these efforts, it's possible that the Kyoto process would have collapsed after the US took its sabbatical to study the Knights of the Round Table. It's also interesting to look at what some specific countries are doing in response to the Kyoto Protocol. In 2001, the British government went even further than the EU emissions market and imposed a climate change levy in the form of a tax on business use of fossil fuel-based energy sources. Relief on this tax can be gained by meeting certain targets in the UK emissions trading program. Other countries face very different challenges in meeting their Kyoto targets. For less populated and more agricultural dependent countries like New Zealand, carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel use are not the main problem areas. Though one doesn't like to talk about these things in polite company, believe it or not, cow and sheep burps and farts are a much bigger problem. Cattle and sheep grazing and their subsequent emissions of smelly gases as byproducts of the digestive process contribute an abundance of the most potent of the greenhouse gases, methane. In fact, farm animal farts and burps account for about one half of all greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand. Unlike its less cooperative neighbour Australia, the country of New Zealand has ratified the Kyoto Protocol and had to do something about these smelly air bubbles. In a move that was far less socially acceptable than either the POPs themselves or Britain's climate change levy, the New Zealand government took the drastic step of taxing farmers for the natural bodily functions of their farm stock. They introduced the world's first tax on farting. A farmers' rebellion got underway immediately, and it is unclear what will happen next.
I fart in your general direction.
The Kyoto Protocol will become official international law when the emissions levels of countries that have ratified the protocol amount to at least 55% of total emissions from the developed world. To date, the countries that have ratified Kyoto, including all members of the EU, Canada and Japan, account for about 44% of these total emissions. The US would add another 36% and Russia alone would add 17%. Hence, while the US continues to avoid the protocol, only Russia's ratification can bring it into effect. Now, Kyoto targets are based on 1990 greenhouse gas emission levels, and this benchmark here is the year before the collapse of the Soviet Union. The subsequent economic collapse in this region has meant that today, Russia's emission levels are actually about 30% lower than its Kyoto targets. By ratifying Kyoto, the protocol would become international law and Russia would then be able to start making money by trading its excess emission credits. Rob Bradley at Climate Action Network discusses the situation in Russia.
What do you think is the outlook for Russia now to ratify the protocol?
I think back to the old good old Kremlinology days, you can always find somebody to tell you almost anything. But I think the signals that we're getting from our Russian members are broadly positive, that we're expecting Russian ratification. It's a question of when rather than if. But of course, you know, there are plenty of competing interests in Russia, and they'll all make sort of Delphic comments at one time or another. But certainly President Putin's recent remarks have been steadily more positive about the Kyoto Protocol.
Do you think that the US is putting pressure on them not to ratify?
It's very hard to say. I mean, certainly a number of people have suggested that they are, and some of the U.S. climate team does seem to spend a disproportionate amount of time in Russia. So I think, on the whole, the U.S. administration would prefer to see Russia not ratify, simply because the continuing existence of an international regime to deal with a problem that the Bush administration says doesn't exist is probably a bit of embarrassment.
Steve Drummond elaborates on the pivotal role of Russia.
What are your expectations about Russia ratifying the protocol?
Well, there are a lot of people hoping that they will, of course. It's a bit of a balancing act. A couple of years ago, the Russians were expecting that they would have thousands and thousands, or tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of companies wanted to buy credits from them, and that they would hold a very strong position in, be almost like the OPEC of the carbon market. But with the withdrawal of the United States and then the European Union's curtailing the ability of European companies to buy the sorts of credits that the Russians have for sale, what it means, in effect, is that the Russians, instead of having hundreds of thousands of customers now, have a few politicians to sell to on a government-to-government basis, which isn't quite the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on the one hand, yep, they have a position where they're a net seller, so they can create revenue by signing. On the other hand, it's all tied up in it's not really financial transactions anymore, it's political transactions.
Well, and on that topic, might they then use this whole issue as a bargaining chip to get something else they want, like entrance to the WTO or something else?
I don't know what bargaining chips they're using. That is naturally the case. The European Union, in particular, would not like to think that it had killed the Kyoto Protocol. And so they are negotiating hard. Quite what the detailed terms of those negotiations are, I don't know.
Do you know if the US is putting pressure on Russia not to
sign? No, I don't
sign.
Know. But
okay.
There is a lot of speculation and comment that they are, but who knows?
And on that topic, whether or not Kyoto officially comes into effect, I'm assuming that the EU will continue on its current path, and so will Japan, Canada, and other countries.
That's not necessarily so.
Okay.
I think that it would be very hard for the Japanese government, given their long deflationary position, to justify quickly what would essentially be a voluntary emissions trading scheme if Kyoto was to fail. At the moment, really, the reason they're pushing ahead is much more to do with the fact that they want to honour the commitments that they sign up to than they're in a hurry to reduce their emissions. A lot of Japanese industry would heave a big sigh of relief if the Kyoto Protocol was not ratified. And in Canada, the real politic is that Canada's biggest trading partner is the United States. And there are big worries in Canada about balance of trade shifting because the cost of production in Canada going up as a result of limiting energy consumption, which is in effect one big part of limiting greenhouse gas emissions. And so there will be a lot of pressure in Canada as well if the Kyoto Protocol were not to move forward, to simply not go ahead and do anything while the US, its major trading partner, is not doing anything.
Well, isn't that the same situation for Europe as well? Why haven't aren't European companies very worried about similar types of issues?
I think European companies are worried, but also in Europe there's a much stronger tradition of strong Green Party and a strong command and control compliance-based systems for environmental issues. Europe has a long history of very tight environmental controls in all sorts of different areas.
Okay, so it's a cultural difference.
Over the next few months, we can certainly expect to see some very interesting dynamics playing out between the EU, Russia, and the United States. In the final week of July 2003, while the EU was busy putting the final touches on its carbon emissions marker, while New Zealand farmers were rebelling against their Kyoto fart tax, and while Russia was pondering ratification of the protocol, certain high-profile leaders in the United States were continuing to emphasize the importance of the climate of the Middle Ages and labeling the pro-Kyoto team as environmental extremists. Perhaps the man in the US most enamored with the Dark Ages is one Senator James Inhofe, a Republican senator from Oklahoma. He chairs the Environmental and Public Works Committee, and he spoke on the Senate floor in July of 2003. Here's some of what he had to say.
Well, what we're going to do next is to take you to the Senate floor on Monday, where Senator Inhofe spoke. He was speaking about the issue of what he calls environmental extremists, and the whole issue of global warming.
I've offered compelling evidence that catastrophic global warming is a hoax. That conclusion is supported by painstaking work of the nation's top climate scientists. We have those scientists included. What have they concluded? They concluded the Kyoto Protocol has no environmental benefits. Natural variability, not fossil fuel emissions, is the overwhelming factor influencing climate change. Satellite data confirmed by NOAA, balloon measurements, confirms that no meaningful warming has occurred over the last century. And climate models predicting dramatic temperature increases over the next 100 years are flawed and highly imperfect. And so, if you look at what they say, study that, you'll come to some conclusions. These are objective scientists, not fundraisers for some far-left environmentalist extremist groups. Finally, I return to the words of Dr. Frederick Seitz, a past president of the National Academy of Sciences and a professor emeritus at Rockefeller University, who compiled the Oregon petition. He said, "There is no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will, in the foreseeable future, cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and the disruption of the Earth's climate. Moreover, there is substantial scientific evidence that increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide produce many beneficial effects upon the natural, plant, and animal environment." These are sobering words, which the extremists have chosen to ignore. So what could possibly be the motivation for global warming alarmism? Since I've become chairman of the Environment Public Works Committee, it's becoming pretty clear. It's fundraising. Environmental extremists rake in millions of dollars not to solve environmental problems, but to fuel their ever-growing fundraising machines, part of which are financed by the federal taxpayers.
Senator Inhofe, just before your speech on the Senate floor the other day, you said that this was probably going to be a politically stupid speech.
It's politically stupid, Connie, because no one takes on the environmentalist groups. They are huge. They have the millions of dollars that they put in there, and of course, they're fundraising all the time, and that's what a lot of this stuff is all about. And since I chair the Committee on Environment Public Works, I just feel an obligation to tell the truth to the American people about what's going on in some of the when I first became chairman of the Environment Public Works Committee, I made three totally outrageous commitments. One was we were going to be basing our decisions on sound science. Number two, we would look at cost and have a cost-benefit analysis. And I mean, those are really outrageous. Many of these environmental organizations, when they say you're going to use sound science, they just go crazy.
Who are the environmental experts?
Well, there are just a lot of them. They range all the way from the Sierra Club to the Natural Resources Defense, the Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, Save the Forest, and as I say, most of them are out there, and I said this on the Senate floor, that are really out there raising money, and they're raising a lot of money.
Global warming is a hoax?
You know, I really think it is.
What do you do to stop these environmental extremists that you call them?
Well, you know, I'm trying to tell the truth, but I gave a detailed history of the science and the lack of science behind some of these things. And, of course, the immediate thing was CO2, carbon dioxide, global warming. Let's go back to the medieval warming period. The medieval warming period happened between about 1000 AD and 1350. And during that time, the Earth was actually warmer than it is today. Then we went into what they call the Little Ice Age. That started 1350 to about 1900. And during that period of time, it got colder. Then, now this is interesting. I think it's probably the most key part of this whole debate. They went from 1900 to 1940 into another warming period. Then all of a sudden, from 1940 up until about the middle 70s or the late 70s or 1980, we went into a cooling period. Now, what happened in the 40s? There was an 80% increase in CO2 in terms of emissions. And so if there is if that causes global warming, why did it go in precipitate a cooling period for 40 years? And that's exactly what happened. So I think we need to look at these things logically, look and read what the hysterical people were saying 25 years ago, that we're going into this ice age and all that, and just realize and we have a chart that goes back about 400,000 years, and it graphs the temperatures over a period of time. And it shows that we're right on schedule in the same types of fluctuations, and there's no reason to get hysterical. Particularly when the cost, and sometime I hope that someone calls in and asks, you know, what is wrong with signing on to Kyoto? What's the downside? Because it'd be a very, very expensive thing.
Rob Bradley at Climate Action Network talks about the U.S. and carbon emissions.
I don't think anybody's now expecting the U.S. to join in this round. It's not just about rejecting Kyoto as such, but the U.S., and this really went under the Clinton administration as well as the Bush administration, has largely adopted not to do anything about climate change. That's not to say there aren't, you know, good activities going on at state level and so forth, but the federal response has really been absolutely minimal. And so that means that the U.S. has progressively sort of essentially backed itself into a corner over this. Its emissions are rising so fast that it's difficult to see under any administration now the political will to do an about turn on that. Now, could the situation evolve far enough that sort of come the second commitment period the U.S. could come back in? Well, we absolutely hope so. And I think that will depend on a few things. One is public opinion in the U.S., but it'll also depend, I think, on the success of implementing this protocol in the countries that are going to implement it. You know, certainly our message for the EU is that there's no stronger argument when going to talk to the U.S. than saying, you know, we actually managed to cut our emissions at home. We did it with real policies and measures that have actually not crippled our economy but have created new opportunities. And that's the kind of thing that's going to win over the Senate.
Steve Drummond at COE2.com discusses the US position as well.
And if Kyoto does go officially into effect, do you think that it would have to put pressure on the US to go in the same direction?
There is a general expectation that the US will be in the second Kyoto period, which starts in 2013. perhaps more compellingly, a lot of the large heavy industry, which is affected by greenhouse gas emissions legislation, plans on a very long timetable. You know, if you're investing in a power plant or in an oil refinery or something like that, you invest on a 30-year time horizon. And many companies believe that if you're going to bet that there's going to be no limitation on the emission of greenhouse gases in the next 30 years, then that's a pretty brave bet. Now, if legislation is still open, you have an expectation that greenhouse gases, the emission of greenhouse gases will not be a free good forever. So therefore restrictions will come into place at some point, but you don't know when. That uncertainty is very difficult to plan for and has its own cost.
At what point would it be too late for the US to ratify for this round? Is it already too late?
When people talk about this topic in the international fora, they say, well, it's too late, really. It would all be too hard. I think that there's simply no appetite in the European... there's no appetite on behalf of the European negotiators to sit down and discuss how to adjust the legislation to accommodate US position and US requirements.
Well, perhaps the US may end up stuck in medieval times after all, if the rest of the world moves ahead quickly without it. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 21. Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can get the text and references of all episodes.